Well, good morning again. It's good to be with you this morning and look forward to the services that we will have together through Wednesday evening. It's a delight to be reunited with you. It doesn't seem like it's been 11 years since we were together, but I suppose it has been. I look forward to coming and being with you again. Surprised at how many of you were here 11 years ago. Things change so much these days. It's been very long. When you go back to visit a congregation, chances are it'll be a different congregation. It's so good to see you again, and look forward to our studies together as the week progresses. We are talking about diligently seeking God, and if you're familiar with the New Testament at all, you would know that that phrase comes from Hebrews 11, verse 6. And in this series, we're really talking about trying to take God more seriously. And there really is not a single one of us who doesn't need to do that. We all take God seriously, or we wouldn't be here this morning. But we can give Him a higher honor than we ever have in the past. We can have a more serious regard for Him. That really is the key idea of Hebrews 11, verse 6, where we are challenged to seek Him diligently. And whether we've ever done that in the past or not, now's the time to make a new commitment to seek God, and not just a little bit, but to seek Him diligently. Our lesson during the Bible study period, we talked about the importance of understanding that we can actually please God. That can be our hope and our aim in life. And so now, in the same verse, we want to look at the part of this verse that has to do with believing God. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. We must believe that God is. And you might be sitting there saying, well, Brother Henry, do we really need this particular lesson in the series? We already do believe that God is, or we wouldn't have come to this assembly this morning. And obviously we do believe at some level, but in all honesty, it has to be said that whether you would be guilty of this or not, we live in a day where the religion of a lot of people, the faith that they might say that they have, is little more than a hand-me-down religion, something that they have inherited from their forefathers. And I was amazed a few weeks or maybe a month or so ago that in our paper down in Indianapolis there was a report of a new national study that has been done on the religious beliefs of the American people, and they identified four separate concepts of God that Americans tend to have. And but the astounding thing about that survey to me was that it reported that over 98% of the American people say they believe in God. Well, that doesn't jive too well with the crime rate, does it? If 98% of us say we believe in God, there are obviously a lot of people who are not doing very much about that belief and doing things that are inconsistent with believing God. People are asked whether they believe there is a God. People say all kinds of things, you know, to an opinion poll taker. But when you look at the way people really live their lives, even in the case of people who go to some kind of church services on a fairly regular basis, when you look at the way people live when they're not at the church building, sometimes we see people living worldly lifestyles and having carnal attitudes that would be inconsistent with a belief in God. Sometimes you see people that are not very involved in the life of the congregation, and they attend services, but they kind of let it go at that, keep the congregation at arm's length. Many people who would say they believe in God don't know very much about the Scriptures. I'm amazed sometimes when I go various places preaching and cite a what you would think would be a fairly well-known passage of Scripture and ask people to turn to it, that people have difficulty finding. Sometimes even the book of Acts or the Gospel of Matthew, we just are largely ignorant of what's in the Scriptures sometimes. And I'm afraid that the ease with which the devil tempts us to commit sin, our vulnerability to temptation, indicates that whether we may say we believe in God or not, our faith may not go very much deeper than just words that we say. Ours may be a so-called Christian nation. I would question the accuracy of that title, but I'm afraid few people really do believe that there truly is a God to whom we will one day account. And we may worship with what we would call a faithful congregation. But many places that would designate themselves a faithful congregation, I'm afraid faith is in short supply sometimes, real faith. Scriptures talk, for example, in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5 about a sincere faith. Or in 2 Timothy 1 and verse 5, Paul talked about the genuine faith of Timothy's mother and grandmother. Well, if there's such a thing as a sincere faith or a genuine faith, that would mean that there would be some other kind of faith that would, you maybe could call it faith, but it really wouldn't be a sincere or a genuine faith. What about that? What's the quality of our faith? This passage says we must believe that God is. Don't we already believe in Him? Well, let's think for a few minutes about moving further up the continuum between not believing at all that there is a God and having the genuine faith that God really wants us to have. All of us are somewhere along the line of progressing more in the direction of a more sincere or a more genuine faith. So, this lesson, please don't think that I think I'm preaching to an audience of atheists that I need to convince about the existence of God. I'm simply challenging all of us, myself included, to take a step toward a really more authentic or genuine faith that God really is. And I want us to begin by looking at the contrast between what I'm just going to call traditional faith, hand-me-down religion, and what the Bible would call saving faith or genuine faith. Let's first of all start with the real thing, with saving faith. Think first of all about the fact that there are some ingredients of saving faith. And we've got an incompatibility between my PowerPoint slides and your version of PowerPoint. So when at home, those points would come up one at a time. In New England, they all come up together. So I can't keep the next 2 points secret from you. You can see them all three there at the same time. But let's talk about them individually. Three elements, I think, that you have to have if you're going to have what the Bible calls faith. And the first of them is the most obvious, and that is credence. To give credence to something means that you believe it's true. That's accurate. And there are some things, there are some facts that have to be believed as true in order to be saved in Christ. Jesus said in John 8 and 24, unless you believe that I am He, you'll die in your sins. Well, that's an intellectual fact, isn't it? Either you do believe that Jesus was the Son of God or you don't. And so faith starts with giving credence to the truth of certain things. But more than that, faith also involves confidence. Back in 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 12, Paul said, I know whom I have believed, and I am persuaded that He is able to keep what I have committed unto Him until that day. Now that's more than Paul just saying that he believed Jesus was the Christ, the Son of God. He's saying, I have confidence in this person whom I believe is the Son of God. And he was willing, really, you know, at the level of real life, to depend upon this person that he said he believed in. And so that's another element, isn't it? There are a lot of people who intellectually might say, well, yeah, I believe Jesus was the Christ, but they really don't have any confidence in Him in the way they live their lives. So we need to be not just to believe the what about Jesus Christ. Paul says, I know whom I have put my trust in. And then that, of course, should lead to the third element of saving faith, and that is constancy. You can't just start out believing. We've got to keep on believing. So in 2 Timothy 4, verses 7 and 8, which our brother read for our scripture reading, Paul says, I have kept the faith. So when you put those three together, credence, believe certain things are true, based upon our belief in those things, we put our confidence in Jesus Christ Himself as the Son of God, and we keep the faith, we constantly maintain our allegiance throughout the balance of our lifetime, then faith becomes faithfulness. And that's what God is looking for. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10, the Lord said, be faithful unto or until death, you receive the crown of life. So, what about you? On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your own faith in all three of those areas? Probably in area number one, we'd give ourselves a 10, wouldn't we? That would give you a checklist of items that you believe are true or not true. You'd probably check off all of them and say, yes, I believe that's true. But what about number two? I wouldn't rate myself a 10. And number two, would you? There are times when, despite what I say I believe, I just don't have as much confidence in God as I ought to when it comes to the making of real world decisions. I know a family down in southern Indiana. They probably wouldn't want you telling about this so that you don't tell that I use this as an example, and I won't give you their name. But they have 10 children. And the husband and his family works in an occupation where you don't make a lot of money, but they get by, feed their kids, and they have just a very wonderful, loving, spiritual-minded family. And they live in a place where there is just the perfect congregation for their family to be a part of. They have thrived there spiritually, and they've long believed that it was just providence that they ended up there and were able to be a part of that congregation. Well, the man was laid off from his job. Or not laid off, the company said, if you're going to continue to work for this company, we're going to transfer you to a city far away. And as they thought about that and they prayed about that as a family, they decided, well, spiritual priorities being what they are, here's where we need to be. And so we're going to make the decision to stay here, and we're going to have to trust that the Lord will work out the details and there'll be a way for us to make a living and continue to live here. If that family told me, we don't just believe Jesus is the Son of God, we trust Him, I believe them would. Because in real world tough decisions, they demonstrate that they're willing to take some risks based upon that faith. Would you do that? Would I do that? We say we believe, but when we have to make some tough decision, sometimes we pull back and try to hedge our bets and protect ourselves and take the safe course of action rather than risking something that would involve trusting that God is going to, we do His will, that He'll work out the details. So would you rate yourself where between 1 and 10 in terms of confidence? And of course, constancy, the jury's still out, isn't it? We've been faithful to this point, but some of us may have a lot of life yet to live, so the tale has not been told in terms of whether we will keep the faith or not. But I believe you have to have all three of those to have genuine, saving faith. But in contrast to that, think about the kind of faith that some people have who just are what they are because that's what their parents were. I'm tickled to death that I'm speaking to an audience this morning in which case not all of you did continue along the path that your parents taught you. Some of you are first generation Christians, and that tickles me to death to be able to talk to people who came to the Lord on their own and you have taken a stand that was not simply a rubber stamp of what your parents taught to you. But if you come back home with me to Indiana, that wouldn't nearly be as often the case. In most congregations that you would go to, probably 95% of the group would be made up of people who come from families where for generations back people have been trying to follow the Lord. And in that case, there'd be just a lot of people whose faith wouldn't be any more than really not their faith, but the faith of their fathers. What about that kind of traditional faith? As I hesitate even to use that term, because I don't want you to think that I'm saying that there's anything wrong with tradition, per se. You'd be hard put to find somebody more traditional than Gary Henry. I mean, look at how radically I'm dressed this morning. How preppy is that? How traditional, you know? I love tradition, and I have a serious bone to pick with people who just want to throw away tradition for the sake of doing something in some way that never has been done before. That's crazy. You lose a lot of the really good stuff in life when you just thoughtlessly throw away tradition. But when it comes to serving the Lord, our faith has got to be more than tradition. If you were fortunate to have been taught the truth about God and about His Son Jesus Christ by your parents, don't think that that's a bad thing. You had a great advantage. You got a head start. But your faith has got to progress at some point beyond merely what you were taught to believe by your parents or by others. Think of this, the characteristics and the differences that distinguish traditional faith from saving faith. Even in the New Testament, don't we read about people among the Jews who just put great store in what our forefathers taught. And they didn't know anything except what they had been taught to believe. They kind of had picked everything up along the way. Well, today, there are a lot of people who religiously, about all you can say for them is that they're just going with the flow. And if they are worshiping among the Lord's faithful people, it's just because they had the good fortune to be in the right flow. It just worked out that way. But their faith is not really their own. It's a faith of convenience rather than conviction. And really, in the case of folks like that, the characteristic of their faith is that they really don't own it. They're just kind of renting it from somebody else. It's just a matter of the environment that they happen to have been in. From a scriptural standpoint, there's some big differences between that and real faith. For one thing, people who have nothing more than a faith of tradition have usually not examined their faith very much. They've really not thought that through or studied that out on their own. And it's usually a faith that hasn't been tested very much. How many people do you know who lost their faith, quote unquote, when they went off to college? Well, that sometimes is going to happen even when a person's faith is genuine. And people sometimes do make shipwreck of the faith, unfortunately. But I'm afraid sometimes when people's faith is tested really for the first time in their life and it quickly evaporates under some kind of testing situation, that is sometimes an indication that they really didn't have much real faith to start with. That they just believed what mom and dad believed, and now the first time some real hardship tested, it evaporates. Real faith, though, Peter talked about in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6 and 7, that persecution, for example, purifies or refines our faith just like gold would be refined by fire. And that's a good thing. Real faith has been tested and has stood the test. But worst of all, traditional faith is different from real faith in that those who only believe what has been handed down to them can't do what Peter talked about in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15 when he said that we are to be able to give a defense, a reasoned explanation of the faith that is within us with meekness and with fear. I was talking to our folks back home at Westside in Indianapolis a few Wednesday nights ago. We had a lesson on reincarnation. And so we got talking a lot about Hinduism, from which the basic idea of reincarnation comes. And some of our members live in somewhat of a limited world as far as their experience of the wider world out there, and had never thought about the possibility of ever talking to somebody like a Hindu about the gospel. And they said, "Brother Henry, how would you do that at all? You can't, your personal work series is not going to work very well with a Hindu. They don't even believe in the same God that we do." And I said, "Well, you just start by explaining to them why you became a Christian." And some of them looked at me like, "Well, I'm not sure why I became a Christian, except that I grew up in a certain community and we worshiped with a certain church, and there was a Sunday when a bunch of the teenagers went forward to be baptized, and I did too. And that's not going to be very impressive to a Hindu." And right. If you can't give a defense of the faith that is within you, if you don't know why you are one of the Lord's people, then you probably don't have a faith that is very much the real thing. So there's a big difference, isn't there, between what the Hebrew writer talked about when he said believing that God is and just having grown up in an environment where a lot of other folks said that same thing. There are three particular dangers of traditional faith. One is it won't stand temptation. The devil loves to pick on people who just have a faith that has been handed down to them. Those are pretty easy to pick off by the devil. It can't stand hardship either. You may sail along pretty comfortably in your life without any hardship going on, just being what mom and dad and grandfolks were and all of that. But you let some terrible tragedy sweep over your family, and you have to then figure out whether you really believe what you said you believed or not. Real faith will stand some hardship when other kinds of faith may not. But worst of all, the danger of just traditional faith is that it won't stand up under the Lord's judgment. Matthew 7, verses 22 and 23, Jesus said that there will be many in the day of judgment who will cry out, "Lord, Lord, what do you mean we're lost?" Many will say to me in that day, "Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name and cast out demons in your name and done many works in your name?" And then I will declare to them, "I never knew you," and they certainly had never known him, "depart from me, you who practice lawlessness." Those were people who surely would say, "Yes, we believe that God is. In fact, we are his special people." The Lord would say, "Depart from me. Even the things you did in my name weren't really based upon saving faith." And in Matthew 15, talking again to the Pharisees, or about the Pharisees, he said, "These people draw near to me with their mouth, and they honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." So where are you? Again, let me warn you not to think that I'm criticizing you. If your parents and your grandparents were New Testament Christians, you need to give thanks for that, as I do. I come from a long line of people who were faithful to the Lord, and I wouldn't trade the family that I came from for any family in the world. But our faith has got to be more than just something that somebody else believed was true. We've got to be able to stand up under temptation and hardship, and we want to hear the Lord say in the judgment day, "Well done, good and faithful servant." So here's some steps that we can take, I think, to grow in our faith. We mentioned hardship, and unfortunately, a lot of folks never really confront the issue of how real their faith is until there's some serious crisis in their life that makes them have to wonder about that. And here I want to be just very frank with you. When I was with you 11 years ago, in April of 1995, the week that I was with you, I stood on the brink of a personal crisis that literally ripped my world apart and that I had no way of knowing was coming when I was with you in April of 1995. Within 3 months of my time with you at that time, my wife of 17 years decided that she no longer loved me, she decided that previously, but she informed me that that was true, that she no longer cared to be my wife, and she left me and my two boys. And my life since then, those 11 years, have been years of horrendous suffering and crisis and spiritual peril for me and my boys. I was 45 years old in 1995. Been preaching the gospel for a long time. I don't remember what I preached about in 1995. It probably had something to do with faith, believing that God is. And I would have said, "Yes, I believe that God is." But I very quickly was plunged into an ordeal in which I had to decide whether I really did or did not believe what I had long been saying I believed. I'm not yet where I need to be. But I tell you this, God is a lot more real to me than he was when I stood before you the last time. And somebody asked me a few months ago when I talked about some things like that. They said, it's a dear sister who came to me after a lesson, and she said, Gary, are you saying that a person has to have suffered like you suffered in order to have a real faith? I said, no. You don't have to. You could be wiser than I was. You could address that issue before the crisis comes and decide that you're going to have a real faith. And if you did, you'd be a lot wiser than I was. I said, unfortunately, to my shame, the Lord had to hit me up beside the head with a two before to get my attention before I addressed that issue. But I said, it's a lot like, you know, the condition of your heart. Do you have to wait until the doctor says your arteries are clogged up and your heart attack waiting to happen before you start addressing the issue of your health and taking care of yourself and being serious about that? No, but most people do wait until then. There might be somebody who would be wise enough to realize the stakes here and start getting serious about that before it reached a crisis stage. But most people don't deal with the serious issues of life until crisis makes us have to deal with those things. I hope you're smarter than I was. That kind of pain has not dropped you to your knees, caused you to question whether you really believe what you've always said you believe, that you'll do that before it comes to that point. You can't. You'd be very wise to do that. You decide right now that whatever your background was, whether your parents were New Testament Christians or not, that you're not going to waste any more time getting serious about the question of whether you really believe what you say you believe or not. First thing we need to do is be honest about it. A lot of us don't have as much faith as we say we do. And we're not going to grow in our faith until we admit that we need to grow. And that's not just a pious sentiment where we say, well, we all need to have a stronger faith than we do. We need to be honest enough, if it's the truth, to say, I am sinfully deficient in faith. I do not trust the Lord like Abraham did. I wouldn't run the risk that he did. I believe that God is, as long as it's safe to do that. We're a lot like the fellow in Mark 9:24, aren't we, who said, Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. We are somewhere on the spectrum. We do believe, but Lord, help us to believe far more than we do. We can be shockingly out of touch with the reality of what the Lord sees when he looks at our faith. We can think, fool ourselves into thinking that we're in much better shape than we are. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 1, the Lord wrote to the seven churches of Asia, some of which were in much better shape than others. When he wrote to the church in Smyrna, you remember what he said? Revelation 3 verse 1, I know your works, that you have a name, that you are alive, but you are dead. They didn't see it. They not only thought that they were alive, they had a reputation among other congregations for being in pretty good shape. But the Lord said, what I see is that you are dead. You don't believe what you say you do. Really and true. Paul made a strong statement, didn't he, in 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 5. When writing to Christians, he said, examine yourselves whether you are in the faith. You ever do that? As a Christian, honestly address the issue of whether you really are in the faith or not? Try, with the Lord's help, to look at that with brutal honesty. I'm studying the Psalms right now in my personal Bible study, and David was such a remarkable man, wasn't he? I mean, he was truly a great man. And great men are capable of making great errors. And he made some, didn't he? I mean, when he stumbled, he did it big time. But what was it about David that was so refreshing? And it really made him a man after God's own heart. He was honest. And he could pray in Psalm 19, Lord, Help me to see my secret faults. Help me to see what it is about me that you see that needs to be corrected. But it's hard to be that honest, isn't it? We want to live in denial. It's not that river in Egypt either. We have this flattering self-image of ourselves that says, I'm a faithful child of God. I worship with one of the most wonderful congregations on the face of the earth, right here in Tingsboro. We're just doing great. And what a privilege and a pleasure it is to be a part of this. Maybe that's what the folks in Smyrna said. You have a name that you live, but you're dead. And I don't say that to say that you are dead. As far as I can see, you are an exceptionally faithful group of people. But individually, we don't go to heaven on the group plan, do we? Individually, where are you? You examined yourself lately, determined whether you are in the faith. Be honest about our deficiencies. And then we need to feed our faith. I don't have to tell you the things that you would need to do to feed your faith. We're doing one of them this morning, worshiping with other people, so that we can strengthen one another's faith, study the Bible, pray. You can make a long list, couldn't you, of things that you know would strengthen your faith. But are you going to do any more of those this week than you did last week? We know what to do, but we very, very often just keep doing business as usual, and so our faith doesn't grow, even though we know the things that we could do to feed it. But I'm telling you, you need to feed your faith. Faith doesn't stand still. Either it grows or it disappears. There's no happy, safe medium. So we've got to feed our faith. And as we feed our faith, then our faith at some point has to be challenged. It needs to be tested if it's going to be the real thing. And so, if you have to, you need to find some ways for your faith to be challenged. Hardship is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. You don't physically, you don't grow strong sitting in a recliner all the time, do you? You grow stronger physically by your muscles having to meet some resistance that they don't like to have to deal with. Both my sons are serious weightlifters. We're fortunate during their high school years for them to attend a high school that had a really state-of-the-art weightlifting program that they expected all of their athletes to participate in. Whether you played golf or tennis or ping pong, you went through their weight program. And so both my boys really got interested in that. And I got to thinking about the premise, you know, of weightlifting not too long ago. Really, that's a silly kind of a thing to do, isn't it? Just arbitrarily to pick up a bunch of weight and lift it up into the air. Those are artificial, kind of contrived means of putting some load on your muscles. Putting some hardship on your muscles. That really is a substitute for work. You know, it's if you were out doing useful work, your muscles would be tested. But in the absence of that, you find some artificial means of putting some stress on your muscles. Why? Because they don't get stronger if they don't have some resistance to meet. And so, spiritually speaking, if you're in a recliner, you need to get up out of that recliner and find some resistance for your faith to have to meet so that it will be challenged. If not, it's not going to get any stronger than it is right now. Now, don't overdo it. No. Weightlifting, you have to incrementally increase the weight, and you could over-challenge your faith. Depending on where your faith is right now, you could put yourself into a situation that would be more than you could handle with your present faith. So you need to be reasonable in terms of how much would be a healthy challenge and how much would be too much. But our faith needs to be challenged. We need to be meeting some hardship. You need to find some firing line to get out there and get on the firing line so that you have to use your faith so that it's tested by people who don't share your faith, and that will cause it to grow. And then the other part of the cycle then is refreshing your faith. You know, having fed it and then tested it and challenged it, then it will be depleted, it will be tired, and it has to be refreshed. And that's a part of what we do here in this building, isn't it? We meet here to refresh ourselves and to fill the tank back up so that We can go back out there and meet some more challenge, deplete ourselves, come back, be refreshed. But there are things that you do about that on a daily basis, aren't there? You need to have some spiritual refreshment in your life every day. There needs to be some feeding and some challenging and some refreshment going on all of the time. And that's a healthy cycle. If you're doing all of those things, the spiral is going to be going up and up and up. Your faith will become more and more real all the time. Like most valuable things, faith has to be grown, doesn't it? There's no series of lessons that some preacher could come in here and preach to you that would just fix the problem and suddenly everybody in this congregation have a real strong, genuine faith. There's no pill that you can take that will do that for you. There's no seminar that you could go to. There's no quick fix. It's an organic thing that has to be grown. There's no, just like there's no get-rich-quick scheme, there's no get-faithful-quick scheme either. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 15, Paul talked about the only way that it can happen. He said, meditate on these things, give yourself entirely to them, that your progress may be evident to all. Faith is a lot like wisdom. It doesn't come quickly. It has to be grown. And it just takes the passage of a number of years with feeding and challenging and refreshing. Over time, you find your faith becoming more and more the real thing. But we've got to get in the process. We've got to get inside that circle of growth where the good things take place day by day by day. And I expect if you are like I am, your faith will grow by such small increments that you won't see it growing while it's growing. It'll grow physically so slowly that from one day to the next, you wouldn't see it. 2 years, in the case of a child, you'd see a lot of growth. But faith grows slowly, day by day by day. But if we're not growing, we're dying. So let's get in there and start growing it. We say we believe in God, but how much do we really trust God in making our real life decisions? I've tried to teach my boys, especially during the last 10 years, that it does good to do good, whether you can see how that's going to work out or not. That we've got to have the faith to just go ahead and do what we know is the right thing to do and trust that the Lord will work out the details. And that's what faith is. If we don't live like that, then we really don't have any faith. So you probably tell more about your faith, not by your profession when you're at this building, but by what we find out about you tomorrow when you've got some decision to make between the Lord's way and some way that seems like it's going to make more common sense from a worldly standpoint. And if you do it the Lord's way, just like that's going to create great havoc over here in this other area of my life, we're going to find out the quality of your faith by how you make that decision. Whether you trust that putting the Lord first and doing what you know He would want you to do is the right thing to do, and it does good to do good, and you're going to do that trusting that He'll work out the details. Just like Abraham, when the Lord said, leave home, follow me, and I'll work out the details. James Dobson put it colorfully. He said, faith in God, merely just believing in God, is like believing a man can walk over Niagara Falls on a tightrope while pushing a wheelbarrow. I believe there are people who could do that, don't you? Tightrope walkers, they could do that. Trusting in God, though, is like getting into the wheelbarrow. That's a whole different thing, isn't it? It's when tough, real-world decisions have to be made that we find out whether we truly believe that God is. So, in the future, all your faith is that you've just been going with the flow, and you've been fortunate to be in a pretty good flow, be aware of the fact that the world is changing radically. The flow is disappearing. The world is fragmenting and disintegrating. The norms are disappearing. Traditionally defined religious groups are fragmenting and breaking apart. And the time will come when the flow may not be there. You'll just have to decide on your own whether you're going to serve the Lord or not, regardless of whether anybody else is or not. I believe it has never been more important than now, in our age, to decide what kind of faith we're going to have. Does Hebrews 11:6 say, "He who comes to God must believe that He is." Tonight, Lord willing, in our lesson, we're going to step up to the question of what's involved in seeking God. Why do we have to seek Him? Is He playing games with us? Is He hard to find? Why do we need to seek God? So I hope that you can be with us tonight to think about that very important aspect of this series of studies. You're here this morning, and there's some way in which we can assist you in taking a step that you know you need to take in order to be more what the Lord wants you to be. And we sing a song that we hope the words of the song would encourage you. We provide this opportunity as a matter of convenience to make it as easy as possible for you to say yes to the Lord's invitation. Only you can make the choice. You'll have to make the decision. And you'll have to have the courage. We can encourage you to do what you need to do, to help you by hearing your confession and baptizing you into Christ this very morning so that you would begin your life as a child of God. Or if you've done that in the past, but you've fallen away from the Lord and need to come back home to a God who surely wants you to come back home, and we'd love to encourage you and help you. Won't you come over, stand and sing the invitation song?